From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this most incredible program, Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Michael Cremo joins us with Forbidden Archaeology and Human Devolution. He believes mankind's been around for hundreds of millions of years. While it's now official, as we've been reporting, farmed seafood has now joined tires, toothpaste, toy trains, pet food on the list of tainted and defective products from China that could be hazardous to a person's health. Federal health officials say they were detaining three types of Chinese fish, catfish, bassa, and dace, as well as shrimp and eel after repeatedly testing turned-up contamination with drugs unapproved in the United States for use in farmed seafood. The official said there have been no reports of illnesses, nor do the products, they say, pose any immediate health risk. They stopped short of ordering a ban on the fresh and frozen seafood, which I think they should have. The Food and Drug Administration announcement was the latest in an expanding series of problems with imported Chinese products that seemingly permeate U.S. society. The Senate has blocked a vote on a landmark immigration bill, dealing a major blow to one of President George W. Bush's key policy planks. Senators rejected a motion to take the bill to a final vote, meaning action on the planned law is now unlikely until the presidential poll in 2008. President Bush had argued the bill would give the immigration system a much-needed overhaul. Conservative opponents said that it would give amnesty to illegal immigrants. The planned law would have enabled some of the millions of illegal immigrants already living here to eventually seek citizenship. Well, fruit chews. Yep, that's what it says on every wrapper of Starburst candy, but that's not stopping a Michigan woman from filing a lawsuit claiming the candy's manufacturer, Mars, Inc., acted irresponsibly by not putting a warning label on the chewy, fruity confection that may be hazardous to denture wearers. The suit, brought by denture wearer Victoria MacArthur of Romeo, Michigan, seeks $25,000 damages from Mars, claiming that she suffered permanent damage when she chomped down on a Starburst chew in 2005. In Port St. Lucie, Florida, a woman arrested after her husband woke up in the middle of the night with a horrible headache. He later learned he had a bullet lodged in his head. They thought maybe originally a stray bullet had hit him, but they said nope, and they've arrested his wife. Researchers will soon visit Michigan's Upper Peninsula next month to search for evidence of the legendary creature known as Bigfoot. The expedition will focus on eastern Marquette County, according to Matthew Moneymaker of the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. Matthew on the line with us right now. Exciting expedition, Matthew. What do you think you're going to find?
Well, we hope we can get close enough to hear him or see him. We've been successful at that on past trips, and we think we've got this area pretty well targeted. We think we did more scouting for this trip ahead of time than we've done for any other trip. It was as if the kind of climate has changed up there. There's a lot of areas that were wet and marshy that are now much drier, and there's a lot less wildlife around. So we had to narrow down the search to figure out areas based on sighting reports about where they would probably be. So, yeah, we're optimistic.
Great. Matthew, what kind of equipment are you going to bring up there with you?
Oh, well, we've got 4 thermal cameras and 8 high-quality sound recorders and night vision scopes and all the things it would take to be able to spread out people in small groups in a big array to record what may be spontaneous sounds, and then we would try to get response sounds. And if we spread the people out in the right way and they've got the right devices and we can actually bring back and hear what they've gotten, we can kind of help better focus where the thermal units go.
There have been at least 4 reports of Bigfoot sightings up in that county. When you are there, I'm going to make sure you and our producers get together. We'd like you to call in reports for us while you're out there, okay?
Absolutely, yeah. We'll have a satellite phone.
And Matthew's website is located and linked right up there at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, Linda Moulton Howe covering the missing honeybees. We turned her loose on another aspect of that story, and also that very bizarre drone, UFO, whatever that may be, when Chad sent it to us, and now we have the report from Isaac. Linda's been following up on that. She's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton Howe, who is covering 2 major stories for us, 2 stories that she has been covering for many, many months now, and they continue to change. Now, you might remember that we got a call several weeks ago from an individual when I was broadcasting out of St. Louis who believes that Chinese products may have something to do with some of the missing honeybees. Linda was checking into that story as well as some other aspects. She's with us now, head of earthfiles.com. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Hi, George. And we are going to hear what I think is the best answer we can get on that Chinese pollen from Dave Hackenberg in Pennsylvania, who has had an apiary there for half a century. But first, I wanted to say, George, when it rains, it pours.
Oh, yes.
This has been one of those weeks where tonight we can't even do justice in this hour to everything that has been unfolding. Not only the incredible Isaac material, which deserves about 4 hours in and of itself, and there's more yet to come on that. And I'll be talking a little bit about that in the second half hour,
right,
when I switch over to drones. But I also have another piece of breaking news concerning the drones. I got a call on Tuesday from a man who's a professional in security. He deals with infrared cameras, the whole nine yards, and he could not believe that at 5:45 a.m., I said Tuesday, I meant Monday, June 25th, he saw with his own eyes one of these drones, and he said, if I had not heard about this story, I would even be more helpless because it was so astonishing, he said, but it reminded me very much of the Chad photo, right?
Yeah.
And for you, for everybody, for all of our Coast listeners, I've got my total interview that was done with him just about 48 hours ago, which we didn't have time to put in this show tonight, but you can go to Earth Files. You can see the entire incredible interview and see that he saw hieroglyphics underneath the tail, like the Chad photos, like the Capitola photos, like the Big Basin photos, but each one is different. And I urge everybody who is interested in these strange dragonfly drones to go to Earth Files and click on that hot link to this other amazing story that has just occurred.
Unbelievable. All right, we'll talk a little bit about that, too. Go ahead, Linda. We're kind of tight force on honeybees. I'll let you go.
Yes.
Go.
Because also the Apiary Inspectors of America reported last week that the still puzzling phenomena of disappearing honeybees that scientists call colony collapse disorder has now been reported in 35 states, 5 Canadian provinces, a dozen European countries, China, Taiwan, Guatemala, and Brazil. And today I learned from the Apiary Inspectors of America President Jerry Hayes, who has been in Russia the past 3 weeks, that Ukraine honeybee keepers have reported massive disappearances through March of this year as well, and no one knew that until he was there. They estimate that a quarter of American beekeeping operations in the United States lost more than 50% of their colonies between September 2006 and March 2007, and that some beekeepers lost 90% or more. And on Tuesday this week, U.S. Senators Barbara Boxer of California, John Thune of South Dakota, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, they introduced legislation, quote, to help research, protect, and maintain America's bee and native pollinator population and ensure the viability of crops that rely on them for pollination. Experts estimate crops nationwide that depend on honeybees for pollination are now valued at $18 billion. And in California alone, that $2 billion a year almond crop requires nearly one half of all the honeybees in the country for pollination. Now, I have talked recently to Marianne Fraser, who is overseeing the investigation of pesticide, about the impacts on honeybees. And George, it's what I've been reporting since March. It appears that rising high on a possible cause of this horrible damage to the immune systems of the honeybees could be pesticides with imidacloprid and the neonicotinoids, the nicotine-based pesticides, where the focus is now. They have found some higher elevations in the wax and in the hives of some of these colonies that collapsed. And one fact is certain, that when Professor Diana Cox Foster reports, quote, "We were shocked by the large number of pathogens present in each adult bee that we studied. The collapse of the immune system is apparently why all these pathogens take over. But what is the cause of that collapse?" And now we're going to move to Dave Hackenberg. I caught up with him in Maine this week. He was up there trying to survive. He lost nearly 80% of his honeybees, and he went into debt to stay in business. He had trucked bees up to Maine. I talked with him on a cell phone, and he is very worried about whether this CCD could reoccur this fall.
In our own operation, we ended up losing probably 80% of them, 75-80% of them. And normally this time of year we'd have 3,200, so we're down 800 hives of bees. We're not back to where we normally should be, and we're not alone. I mean, there's a lot of beekeepers across the country that wasn't able to get their numbers back.
And have you continued to experience disappearances?
Yes, we're still seeing some, not in great numbers, but we're still seeing some colonies here and there that are having the problem. And other guys are too. Bees just don't want to come back right. I mean, there's something wrong. They don't want to build up.
Since you had lost about 80% of your bees, what have you done since October to replace those bees?
One of the things we did, we brought bees in from Australia. Of course, the other thing we did, we radiated a lot of equipment, or most of the dead outs, we radiated them, and we really think that that's helped. I mean, there's no pathogens, no viruses. The scientists tell us something breaking down the immune system. So if you can get rid of all that problem that's there when the immune system is broke down, why, maybe bees have a better chance.
But what if what is breaking down the immune systems are pesticides like the neonicotinoids?
What if? Well, then we, unfortunately, right now, we're trying to run as far away, or try to stay as far away from all those chemicals, those particular chemicals, as we can. Until we figure out what this whole problem's about. I mean, we can't get totally away from them, but we're trying to keep as many bees as we can without coming in contact with those products. Most of our growers that we pollinate for have been real cooperative and haven't used them, and so we're hoping that this is going to work to hopefully keep more of them alive than we did a year ago.
And so one of the biggest changes that you and a few others are trying is to eliminate as many pesticides as possible.
One of the things I do before we go move bees into an area is go around and talk to farmers and see what they're using for insecticides.
And if they say anything in imidacloprid or other neonicotinoids, what do you say?
I'm sorry, we ain't coming back this year. If you look at the literature put out by the manufacturers of the products, they say four things. They break down immune system, they cause memory loss, they cause nervous system disorder, and they cause the insects quit feeding.
And this is the nicotine-based pesticides.
Right. And so basically, that's what's going on inside a beehive.
And are you seeing that your imported Australian bees are better off and healthier than the others?
Well, not really. I don't think you could say that. I mean, they're doing like the rest of them.
Now, what about an issue that has surfaced in the last month or so that some of the beekeepers in the United States were importing pollen from China to help supplement the honeybee food here in the U.S., and that it might have had some toxic properties?
There's a lot of us that have never used that stuff, and I'm one of them. I mean, we've never once in our lives have we ever used Chinese pollen or anybody else's pollen. So, and a lot of other guys that had this problem never used it.
So there's not any direct link at all between the imported Chinese bee pollen and what you've experienced?
Nope. We have never fed collected pollen to bees.
When you've talked just privately with the scientists who are studying it and other beekeepers, do you get that sense that it is the nicotine-based pesticides that might be most responsible?
Well, a lot of beekeepers will tell you that's what they think is going on.
Well, I do remember that when I first talked to you on February 16th, 2007, that you were adamant that you felt that pesticides were somehow related.
Well, I still do. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Right. And then what can the nation and the world do to generally reduce pesticides?
That's an interesting question, because agriculture and everything is pretty much controlled by chemical companies and large seed companies. And now that they have gone together and made agreements between themselves, I mean, it's pretty hard to go up against City Hall. But one of the things is the fact that not only are the honeybees in this condition, we're also finding the lack of natural pollinators that normally have been here. The laboratory in Pennsylvania that makes venom for allergic shots for bee stings, yellow jackets, and so on. The gentleman that runs this business, we sell him bulk bees to make venom to make these shots, and he's telling me they've actually had to import yellow jackets from New Zealand for the last 2 years because they're not here. They normally collect these in the fall when they know the nests are as big as they're going to get, and they've done this for years. All of a sudden, when you go to collect these yellow jackets in the fall of the year, there's hardly any yellow jackets left in them. The nests are there, but the populations are gone.
And this is just the last couple of years?
Last 2 years.
Since 2005.
Right.
And that they've never had to import yellow jackets before?
Nope.
And they're having to go to New Zealand to get them?
Right. You get small orchard people calling up after the fact saying, hey, I didn't have any bees that never worried about it before. Now all of a sudden they're finding there was no, well, I don't got hardly any apples because, you know, there wasn't no bees there. So where did they go? I don't know. Where do wild pollinators go? I don't know. Penn State, they do a survey every several years, I think 97, 2002, and then again this year on the pollinators and apple orchards. And they said the decline was just staggered. I mean, the difference in numbers in the last couple of years was just staggering.
Do you have any professional appraisal now about whether there have been enough pollinators to meet all of the food growing needs?
The job got done. I mean, pretty much the pollination season for the most part is over. I mean, except for vegetables and watermelons and pumpkins, which is not as big a high demand. But here just in Maine alone, where I'm right down the road from where I'm sitting, the company, they brought bees all the way from Bakersfield, California, all the way to the northeast corner of the United States to pollinate the blueberry crop. This is unheard of. I mean, you're trucking bees 3,000 plus miles across the United States to get the job done here. Now, I mean, never before have they had to go to California to find bees to cover the blueberry crop here. The prices they paid were kind of astronomical. We've increased the price here, had a 50% increase in the price of bees this year. They got a good crop of blueberries, but, you know, it's added cost, and somebody down the road is going to have to pay that. Now, that person's going to have to pay it, the consumer. Whether there's going to be enough bees, you know, in the future to get the job done, that's going to depend on what happens down the road. I mean, the next big test is almonds in California. That's not until February. So it's going to depend on what happens with the bees this summer and this winter. If we can survive, total colony numbers are down considerably.
Right. And if colony collapse disorder resurfaces in the fall to the winter of going into 2008, what happens?
Well, then we're short on bees. Then we're definitely going to be short on bees in California, probably. Our own operation this year, I mean, normally we bring 3,000 hives of bees here to Maine. Well, we only had 2,700 to bring.
And what this all boils down to is that the United States right now barely has enough pollinators to meet the food-growing demands.
Right. I mean, there's bees out there. Just the problem is they're not in the right places. And it's going to cost a lot more money to get them moved from place to place. I mean, you know, transportation alone. I mean, I just heard the other day here, transportation alone to get them bees out of California over here costs $40 a hive. I mean, it's only been a couple of years ago that $40 a hive was all we were getting for bees here to pollinate the crop, let alone that the trucking bill alone was $40 a hive to bring them bees over here. You know, if the farmer is going to get his money back, why are you going to have to pass on the consumer?
Mm-hmm. And we are at an unknown juncture then when we don't know if colony collapse disorder is going to come back.
That's correct.
And everyone wonders, will we have enough honeybees and other pollinators for all the farm needs in 2008, George?
Joe, Linda, what a remarkable story, and congratulations on your continuing effort. I got to tell you, you should win a Pulitzer Prize for the work you're doing on this.
Thank you. And this next half hour, I think the story is equally as fascinating.
Okay, we'll get right into that. Linda Moulton Howe up next with the very strange story of the aerial drone, whatever or wherever it may come from or what it may be. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next Friday, I'm going to be in Roswell, New Mexico for their UFO Festival, and we'll be broadcasting Coast to Coast live that Friday night. We must have 15 guests coming and going that night. It's going to be an exciting evening. Stan Crosby's family has lived in Roswell for five generations, and Stan was the founder of the first UFO Festival in 1995 and served as the volunteer chairman for the Roswell UFO Encounter for years 95, 96, and the 50th anniversary celebration in 97. Stan, this is going to be a pretty exciting event. How did the idea of this festival come about because of that 47 crash?
Well, good morning, George. Depending on your time, I guess. We had been involved with the community and doing a lot of things, and the founders of the UFO Festival came and asked if we could do something to generate some interest and maybe pick up, I guess, some attendance at their museum. They had about 3,000 visitors in 1993, and we had visited about trying to generate some, like I said, general interest and see if the visitors would come.
Well, it's grown. How many visitors are now coming to the festivals all the time?
Well, the number's in the millions. What we did when we started out was we started with a volunteer festival, and like I said, in 93 they had about 3,000 visitors through the little storefront museum. Then when they relocated to their current location in 97, that year they had 390,000 visitors through.
Oh, my gosh, Dan. Okay, well, with all the things that have been going on and the latest news that we've been having on the Roswell crash, indeed, lots of interest. What can people expect this year out there?
Well, what we've tried to do is we're a small community, 50,000, and we've tried to make this family-friendly. What we found is that a lot of folks that are interested in the phenomenon come with their families, and not necessarily the entire family is interested in going to lectures and doing the whole bit. So we plan this around the family. We have a carnival atmosphere. We try to present a lot of lectures that are based on the phenomenon, what's going on for the serious ufologist, but we also want to have things for their families.
Yeah, too. You want to have some fun, too. What's your website, Stan?
Well, it's RoswellUFOFestival.com, and there are almost two events going on simultaneously. We have the UFO Festival itself, which is put on by the city, which is the family fair, and then we also have some ufologists speaking at that event. And then the UFO Museum does their own more serious, if you will, type of event. And you can go on that on the RoswellUFOMuseum.com.
Excellent. And you're going to have some groups out there, some bands, right?
Well, we've got, for the younger crowd and the teenagers, we've got the Alan Parsons Project Live and War. Those of us that are a little older, remember the golden days.
Well, you need Guy Lombardo there for some of us.
Hey, well, some of us, we might have him. You know, and we just try to provide a little bit of everything. And there are a lot of, like I said, the very serious speakers. We've always been involved with Stanton Friedman and some of the others, and they're here. And then we try to bring in a little of the avant-garde, if you will.
All right, very good. Stan, I look forward to seeing you next week.
Well, thanks. It'll be fun. We enjoy having you here.
Absolutely. We're going to broadcast the show live next Friday, July 6th. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe and her report on the drone on Coast to Coast AM. Well, months ago, webmaster Lex Lonehood, sounds like a Superman character, doesn't he, received some interesting pictures from a fellow by the name of Chad out there near Lake Tahoe in California, which, by the way, has been burning for some time now, and posted these pictures on the coasttocoastam.com website. Linda Moulton Howe got into the picture and has been following up on this. It has taken an incredible evolution with more from an individual now by the name of Isaac, who claims that he worked on a project in the 80s that was trying to reverse ET technology. Linda, pick up this story, and then we'll talk about some of the breaking news toward the end of this hour.
That's right, and it started Tuesday, June 26th, when this release of an alleged secret report containing photographs of alleged extraterrestrial technologies entitled, quote, Commercial Applications Research for Extraterrestrial Technology. The acronym is CARET, all caps, C-A-R-E-T, and it's Q4-86 Research Report, dated December 1986, Palo Alto, California, by the Palo Alto CARET Laboratory, also known as PACL, another acronym spelled all caps P-A-C-L. The CARET Laboratory's research goal is stated as, quote, achieving a greater understanding of extraterrestrial technology within the context of commercial applications and civilian use, unquote. The document states that the CARET Q486 research, quote, focused on four key subjects, all of which were based on artifacts of extraterrestrial origin obtained from crash site recovery operations conducted during the last two decades within the continental United States. Those 20 years of crash retrievals they're referring to is between 1966 and 1986. The four subjects are listed as one, personal anti-gravity generator, so named for its small portable size. Two, three-dimensional image recorder projector. Three, a complex system of symbols and geometric constructs capable of both defining the functionality of certain artifacts as well as manipulating their behavior, crudely analogous to a computer programming language, but without the need for a compilation or interpretation phase. And four is entirely blacked out in a separate follow-up email. The document's leaker, who calls himself by the alias Isaac, explained that the blacked-out sections had been done by CARET in Palo Alto and not him. Now, Isaac's anonymous submission of these documents and photos might not be as important, George, if there were not so many eyewitnesses. I now have a list of 13, including the incredible one that I was talking about in the first half hour that took place this week near Maxwell Air Force Base down in Montgomery, Alabama. And the first alleged photographs were dated May 5th, 2007, from an anonymous Lake Tahoe, California source. And it's the next day, on May 6th, 2007, that more digital images were taken by a man named Chad in the Bakersfield, California region. The Lake Tahoe images were submitted to UFOcasebook.com, and as you were pointing out, the Chad images were submitted to Lex at Coast to Coast. And he and I talked about the Chad images, and Lex put me in touch with Chad, and Chad and I have had several email communications. Well, since then, eyewitnesses to such a dragonfly-shaped aerial craft or variations on it have gone back as far as 1987 in a hangar at Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. And in addition to Shirley and Sequoia National Park that I have shared on coast, Robert Mariotti in Northridge, California, who's gone on the record with his real name and profession, and another eyewitness who has agreed to talk to me, that was an event in October of 1995, which I'm going to share here in some detail. This is a person who I have come to know, and his exchanges have reinforced his credibility, his background, his professionalism. He has spent his entire professional career in electronics and now works as an automation engineer producing assembly lines and robotics for a major pharmaceutical company. In October of 1995, so we're going back 12 years, he was on a weekend camping trip a couple of miles north of Willow Springs Lake near Payson, Arizona, and also near Eber, where Travis Walton had the abduction back in 1975. Now, this is where Ned sets up his camp on one side of a meadow And then he realized that there were other people on the other side of the meadow bordering where there's a bordering tree line. And he thought that they looked like militiamen, guys out with guns and targets and all of that. And he didn't want anything to do with them, but he thought that his campsite was far enough away to not be bothered. And then something very strange happened.
And I undid all my gear. I was getting my tent up and everything. And I noticed a pair of my arms starting to, like it was raising up. And I know what it's like to be around high level of power, electricity-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I started hearing, like I was near a power transmission line, kind of a crackling noise. Mm-hmm. And I look up and I see this thing. And it's buzzing past me, above me. And I would say, from some of the pictures I've seen, this thing was in the most simplest form that it was at the time.
Now, did you look at the Birmingham, Alabama photograph?
Yeah, that one looks more like it. That's pretty simple form. That's what I'm saying. That looks just like that. Not the later ones where it has all those extra things attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gracefully went about over me. And I'm like, what the hell is that? Not in those exact terms, but pretty much for the family version of it is what I was thinking. When it went past me, I felt as if I was near a power line. Okay, so there was a lot of electrical, and like I said, I could hear the crackling. And it was just above the trees, barely clearing the trees.
And that would be about how high above your head?
Oh, gosh, probably about 20 feet.
Okay.
And so it didn't pay any attention to me. It just bobbed around, and then across the middle ways was all these militia-type people. And it went around, followed the tree line, and got in behind them. And it actually sunk down a ways into the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed there for a while behind those people.
Like it was hiding?
Like it was hiding, watching, and listening. This probably went on for about a good 10 minutes. Then it rose up, and then it took a right and just veered off as gently as you please and disappeared out of sight. And I kept thinking to myself, great, you know, the militia people, great. That's all I need to have done is someone spying on me. You know, I'm not involved in this crap. I mean, I do own guns, but I wasn't involved in any of that kind of stuff. And it just really bothered me, whatever these things are, and following people. So At that point, I basically packed up my gear again and headed back to my truck. So I didn't stick around from there. I was pretty scared. I didn't know what to expect next. Is when that thing sunk down, okay, I could actually see the leaves move on that thing, like it was pushing air down. But I remember now when I watched, I'm looking back in my mind's eye and watching that thing settle in for its, I guess, spying. And watching, I saw leaves move out from the center portion of it, like it was pushing air down.
And these other people didn't have any response?
I don't think they even saw it. That's what scares me, because, you know, it was hugging the treetops and just moving very, when it changed, like if it wanted to change a direction, it was kind of like a skip.
Well, other people who have seen it this year, last year, in 2005, in the air, they try to compare it to either the way a dragonfly moves over water or the way a water bug, a jerky skipping motion.
If it was moving in a constant direction, it was fairly smooth. But when it wanted to change, it was very, you know, it was kind of jumpy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of jumped in the direction.
Since it was only about 20 feet above you, could you see anything in that dragonfly shape that seemed to be responsible for it making a change in direction?
No. Looking at this thing, you know, there were no moving parts. Seeing this thing in pictures brought back the memory. And seeing that thing, the way it was moving, I swear it's using the electrostatic energy
mm-hmm.
to force air down to make it hold up in the air.
Did the ring always stay going forward?
The tail, when it moved into a different direction, the tail would turn first and then it would move. The tail would move first. So if it changed, like if it made a right-hand turn, the tail would move for the ring to be in front.
Almost like it would stop and pivot?
Yeah.
That would match the description of the woman with her two sons last year in June in Yosemite Park. And she said that when they shone a flashlight on it, that it just literally stopped in midair. And then it seemed to make a kind of fast, jerky turn going another direction. And each time they shined light on it, it would make this strange stop and jerky turn, which is sort of maybe like a pivot.
Yeah.
Have you described this machine in the air to anyone else?
Just recently to my sisters.
You didn't talk about it at all until now?
I had a scary experience some years before where I was at the wrong place at the wrong time, and I saw something I shouldn't have. And I was warned the next day not to talk about anything. And that was very fresh in my memory. I didn't want to put myself at risk. So I bit my tongue. I didn't know what it was. And I didn't want to draw attention to myself.
Can you give any indication of what you were warned about?
Oh, I was a stealth fighter. It's out in the open now. I used to work at Goodyear, and I answered an alarm call. This is like 1985. I went out there to answer the alarm call, and I see this silhouette of this plane, and it's having engine trouble. And they landed at the Goodyear Airport, not at Luke Field. And I was like, wow, that's a weird-looking silhouette, you know. And I was talking to the police officer, so I decided to drive up past the old Goodyear plant. And there it was, and there were guys out there with machine guns.
Hmm.
And I went, oh, that's a neat-looking plane. Oh, crap, these guys are looking at me. And then I got a visit at my apartment the next day. So,
did they take down your name and your address and your phone number there at the site?
They were behind a fence. I was driving on a road. They took down my plate number probably. And that's how they tracked me down. What they told me is, if you see this thing on TV, then you can talk about it. But other than that, first they replied about it, said, you know, we're asking you as a patriotic citizen not to say anything to anybody.
And then they became sterner?
They became sterner and said, you know, if you do talk about this, there are things we can do, you know, because this, you shouldn't have seen this, and it's not a good thing that you did. So if you start bragging about this thing, they have found people out in the desert.
They actually said that to you?
Right, right in front of my girlfriend at the time.
An implied death threat?
An implied death threat, and I turned around and told him, I said, look, I'm a patriotic guy, and there's no need for that. All you have to do is say, don't say anything. I'm not going to say anything. At the very end of this thing, they said, if you see it on TV, then you can tell everybody about what you saw. But until then, don't say a word. Seeing that probe, and I was like, great, I don't want to be in another situation where I said something or saw something I wasn't supposed to and talk about it, and then I'm going to have some visit one time.
Right.
I don't want that to happen again.
And so you kept your mouth absolutely shut between 95 and 2007 because of the 1985 run-in with government agents concerning the stealth then, but now we're dealing with what we're not sure what it is, what its origin is, or who made it. And in 2007, with these dragonfly-shaped drones that have been morphing in these shapes and appendages and now to this current very menacing-looking, almost war machine appearance, if it is a black project, why would it be out in the public between 1995, when you saw it, in 2007?
I don't know. What I would be curious about is, what kind of political situation is in the areas that it's going to?
Yeah. Why is it especially being seen only in national parks?
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I don't know. I wish I had an answer for that.
Yeah. And who is behind this is what we would all like to know.
Out of fear, I just kept my mouth shut because I didn't want any issues. My mom and my two sisters, I have to be there for them. And I don't have any kids of my own. I'm not married. But I worry about my mom and my sisters. And the reason why I'm calling you now is because I called my sisters up.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to them. And I told them what I saw.
Right.
And I gave them the whole story. And my family turned around and said, tell them. Tell them what you saw.
Incredible story, Linda. Absolutely. Look, there's going to be more to come on this. And, of course, what you just reported at the top of the hour as well, the breaking story that so many people are seeing this, and the Internet is abuzz everywhere. Linda, let's talk to you later. I'm sure you'll have more for us.
Yes, absolutely, George. Happy 4th.
You got it. Linda Moulton Howe. I'll be back in a moment. Michael Cremo, Human Devolution, Forbidden Archaeology.